You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. In the summer of 2019, months before the COVID pandemic would fuel a massive expansion of podcast availability, an eventual acceptance of this medium, even from the most conservative religious circles, the Yeshiva of Newark launched its platform, fusing an enlightened series of shiurim and contemporary topics presented uncompromisingly with serious interviews and dialogue with important figures in education, psychology, and mystical thought. The result shone important shafts of light on hitherto unnoticed problems and suggesting real solutions. During the global shutdown of in-person learning options and forced quarantines, hundreds of searchers across multiple time zones joined our Zoom live events every afternoon and evening. Sophisticated classes described the fundamentals of Talmud learning for adults who had been underserved. Scholarly old hands joined Shiurim and Yerushalmi and Dafyemi. We were at the forefront of producing Hespedim for so many stalwarts of Torah and Avoda who passed away during the height of the Magefa. These presentations brought comfort and appreciation to the bereaved of our people. The platform routinely chimed in on the relevant issues and upsetting scandals of the day from a rabbinic perspective. We even offered options for healthy, life-affirming entertainment in a world bowled over by streaming services. With downloads approaching the million mark and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe that a niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. This proud edifice I've described is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote the product that has been a balm, an instructor to so many. Just $36 as a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a new arc of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this arc till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of B'loi Ha'aretz Deya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen. Shalom. This is a tribute to Senator Joe Lieberman, Yosef Yisrael ben Chanan, Olav Shalom, who died last week. He was a person that was extremely well known and was a trailblazer in terms of being a frum Jew, an Orthodox Jew, involved in politics on the highest level. In order to properly perhaps give him tribute, I thought maybe we would hear an interview that was conducted 7 years ago between my nephew, Rabbi Ari Koretsky, and Senator Lieberman. This was done as part of Ari Koretsky's very popular and important podcast, Jews You Should Know. Now, considering that was 7 years ago, I spoke to my good friend, Mr. William Rabfogel, who has worked for years in many Jewish communal institutions on behalf of the Jewish people, who had a relationship with Senator Lieberman for many years, and we spoke about him right before the Levaya began. I think you'll appreciate his personal knowledge and insight into what Lieberman's legacy is, and I think you'll also enjoy hearing the living voice of Joe Lieberman himself. The conversation covers many topics about his childhood, the influence of his European Jewish grandmother. You're going to hear about what JFK election meant, Martin Luther King's march in Washington, and in general, the civil rights movement, the therapeutic value of loss. You'll hear about his shocking Senate victory. Of course, about the vice presidential campaign with Al Gore,
and the impact throughout his political life of keeping Shabbos, and of course the book that Joe Lieberman wrote, The Gift of Rest. So we hereby dedicate this program. He should be, as he was in his lifetime, a good Oisbeter, as someone who used whatever influence he can on behalf of Eretz Yisrael and the Jewish people. He should be in the Yeshiva Shalmala. He should be able to add his voice to those that are supportive of not only the Tzochin of Klal Yisrael, but the Sholem to the whole Bria and the Kirov of Mashiach very soon.
Shalom. I'm here with my good friend, William Rabfogel. It's Erev Shabbos, and about 15 minutes from the time we're recording, the Levaya for Senator Joseph Lieberman of Blessed Memory, Olav Shalom, will commence in Agudah Shalom Synagogue in Stamford, Connecticut. He's someone that deserves to be spoken about and to not only just say Le'ili Nishmosei, but to talk about how significant his role was in American life and Jewish life. And I've turned to my good friend, William Rabfogel, who had a relationship with him. Willie, thanks for being with us on a day that they were all saddened and trying to take stock about this very great American politician, but more, much more than that, wasn't he?
Yes. Joe Lieberman was very, very special, not because he was a politician, but because he was a public figure that never lost sight of the fact that he was a frum Jew, and that being a frum Jew and observing Shabbos, observing different Yom Tovim, no matter when he was Attorney General of Connecticut, a U.S. Senator voting on whether or not the United States is supposed to go to war with Iraq, or when he was campaigning for the vice presidency of the United States, the only Jew in a major party to campaign on a national ticket, he made sure that Shabbos was central to his and his wife and his family's life, and that everyone around him, from Al Gore, who was his running mate, to the Secret Service who were working with him, knew that and respected him for it.
He wrote a book that The Gift of Rest, or The Gift of Shabbos.
Right.
It's a book that I know was extolled by many. And I know the OU in their tribute mentioned that in his Shmira Shabbos, and as you say, the general idea that he could be completely and totally engaged in this world and make a difference and still not compromise was a model for many who came after him to say, yes, I can enter that world. They could enter that world, whether it's politics or any sort of business or finance, any sort of aspect of life, and realize that there are ways that it can be accomplished, it can be done, and they didn't have to be ashamed of who they were. Tell me, Willie, how you originally met Joe Lieberman.
So I met him in the mid-1980s when I was working for Harrison Golden, who was the New York City controller, and Joe was the Attorney General of Connecticut at the time. And I believe it was at a pro-Israel or a free Soviet Jewry rally. And, you know, we just briefly got to talking, and together with Jay Golden as well. I remember introducing him to Jay Golden's father, who at the time had already hit 90 years old. And he was so incredibly respectful of a Zaken. And, you know, there was something to see about the manner in which he carried himself, which was not typical to the other elected officials who were there. They were there to get up, they were there to speak, and to get out. Joe was there, he spoke to people. He cared about his conversations with people. And you came away feeling something, that this is a unique person, because it wasn't just about, you know, coming in, doing the event, getting your 5 minutes of speaking in and getting out as quickly as possible. It was more about engaging people. I didn't hear from him probably for about 2 years after that. And in 1987 or early 1988, I got a call from him asking me to introduce him to two public figures, because he was starting to do his run against Lowell Weicker for the U.S. Senate in Connecticut. And I didn't know him very well, but, you know, again, here was a conversation that he could have had in 3 minutes. But we went on in terms of first, you know, it was talked about family, asked about my family, which we didn't know each other really. And he began to engage in finding that out. And then asked me for this favor to make these introductions, which I was pleased to do. But he then went into why he thought this was an important race to make and why, as a religious Jew, he believed he could be a Kiddush Hashem. And, you know, that was a word that he used frequently, that he wanted to use his office, whatever the issue may have been, whether it was voting on behalf of the Gulf War in Iraq under the first President Bush or voting to go to war with Iraq against Saddam Hussein with the second President Bush. He came up with rational arguments, reasonable arguments, and he always felt that it was important that he just didn't simply vote, but that he explained his vote so that people understood that this individual who was a firm Jew had legitimate reason how things were defensive. We weren't going on the offense. This was about protecting Americans and saving what he believed was society from the people who perpetrated, in the case of the second Gulf War, who perpetrated 9/11. And so, you know, these were things that mattered to him greatly. I would, you know, after working for Jay Golden, I would ultimately be working for the OU for several years, setting up their Washington office, began working and seeing him on a regular basis. Indeed, at one point, the OU had a convention, I think it was in 89 or 90 in Washington, D.C., where on Shabbos, he walked from his home to the hotel, I believe it was the Grand Hyatt, to speak. And I had to walk from the hotel where I was staying to his home shul to speak at his shul. So we passed each other on the way.
You mentioned when I said that he was a very important player in politics, the word politics is you sort of winced because it's considered such a pejorative. But if you go back to the original meaning of politics, which is working in for the community, the polis. The polis is, like we say, metropolis. It's for the greater good of the community. It really does mean that. It's unfortunate that people who didn't have Lieberman's convictions, who were, you know, who were just all about bombast and pushing and getting power and control, they've made that term politics a dirty word.
It's gotten only worse these days. But you reflect on something that reminds me of a speech I wrote for Ed Koch when he was mayor many years ago in New York City. And it was about the definition of politics, which is the education of our children, the protection of our families, the ensuring that people are able to go from place to place without fear, to take care of our elderly and those who are weak among us. That is what really politics is all about, and the governance which comes from politics, which unfortunately so many have lost sight of in the current, you know, dog-eat-dog world. I mean, we don't have the politics that Joe Lieberman had in terms of respecting his opponents. I mean, you know, Ned Lamont, the governor of Connecticut, was on the air recently to comment on his old adversary who defeated him in a Senate race. After Lamont defeated Lieberman for the Democratic nomination, Lieberman ran as an independent and defeated Lamont for the Senate seat. And Lamont went on to talk about how he and Lieberman established a friendship following that race, which is a bitter race, which Lieberman obviously cared enough to stay in the Senate that he took on the uphill battle of running as an independent. And Lamont said he grew to respect the comity that Lieberman was about in terms of dealing with those people who you essentially fought with for nominations, for elections. You fight with, you know, your quote opponents, whether, you know, Lieberman was a Democrat for most of the time in the Senate, yet his relationship with people like John McCain, who was a Republican, are incredibly noteworthy of how good they were as friends, which is so unusual in the politics of today. So that we look back and say, how is that possible? But that was Joe.
We mentioned, you know, when I called you last night, you mentioned to me his friendship with Dick Cheney. And I said to you that that debate that Cheney and Lieberman engaged in when Lieberman was the vice presidential candidate running with Al Gore. And I think it was one of the most unique debates that we've had in the last 25 or 30 years, where two fellows spoke in measured tones without attacking, delineating the differences between them, and really created a symbol, a template. Unfortunately, it hasn't been followed, of how one can disagree with someone, how one can make their point, how one can appreciate, as you say, the person that they are battling, but can still appreciate and afterwards work together with them, whoever wins. And that is something that, as you say, the partisanship is so strident, so terrible, that both sides are just yelling at each other how terrible the other side is.
Right. No, I recall actually seeing Joe was on some news show probably 4 years ago. And I remember they asked him about Liz Cheney and the role she had taken on in being the anti-Trump. And Lieberman, in his very typical diplomatic and tactful fashion, avoided the issue of Donald Trump, but he talked specifically about, you have to think about how Liz Cheney was raised and what a remarkable family she comes from to be able to take on this issue, which has made her so unpopular among, and she was still in office, she hadn't lost a congressional seat. But, you know, Joe was defending her and talking about how her family should be emulated, because it showed that she cared so deeply about her principles, whether it was Trump or another principle, that this is something that we need to instill in our families and our children, that principles matter. And it's not about selling out. It's not about just going with the flow. It's about, this is something that mattered to them. And Dick Cheney and his wife instilled in their daughter the belief that this is something that mattered. And that's what Joe saw in this. He didn't see the conflict between Liz Cheney and Donald Trump. He saw how important her upbringing was, because as a Orthodox Jewish parent, he obviously put himself in their shoes and, I imagine, wondered, would his children adhere to those kind of principles, the principles that mattered to him and his family? And you know, I found that interview to be remarkable, the way he stuck to his guns.
Connectivity to how one was raised and parents and grandparents. In the interview that we're going to append to our little conversation that happened 7 years ago with my nephew, he talks about the very important influence of his grandmother, how his European grandmother was the type of religious principles, the type of a love and care and concern, how that inspired him, even when he sometimes felt that the pressures of giving up orthodoxy and what we would call Shmiras HaMitzvahs, he was called back to that by the death of his grandmother, by the birth of his child. He was very, very anchored in a real way to family. And another thing that I think comes across about him, despite, you know, we talk about sort of like what I mentioned, this model of respecting the ones that you are engaged in debate with and understanding how you need to work together. You sort of alluded to it, Willie, was his his conviviality, his gregariousness. He really comes across as a, not just like a glad hand or schmoozer, but as someone who really enjoys talking to you and learning from you.
Right. He enjoyed the relating to another individual. And when he liked that individual, you know, you could see it. He didn't hide it. His face shone with appreciation for somebody that he enjoyed a conversation with. And you know, you just saw it. His eyes twinkled. His mouth smiled. It was just a crinkling of wrinkles on his face. It was just a genuineness that came across from somebody who enjoyed other people. He enjoyed people who we felt had a common bond with him. Again, they didn't have to be Jewish. I mean, they could be John McCain or Lindsey Graham.
Right. He was a person of deep emotion and a person who, you know, as you said, sacrificed for his principles. Before we get to his, you know, the ascension to almost being the vice president of the United States, I think there was one area that I think a couple of people took issue with during his political life was his support for affirmative action, his support for abortion. As someone who was calling himself an Orthodox Jew, someone who kept Shabbos, someone who, you know, it was so obvious that he was, you know, he would confer with Rabbonim to decide when he could cast a vote and could he right. get into a car. You know, the fact that he was willing to support abortion in ways that might, you know, that seem contra halacha, I think is something that we have to mention.
Right. Yeah. I've known other Frum politicians, elected officials who did so as well. And again, in consultation with truly Gedolei Yisrael in doing it on several levels. Number one, that, you know, these were trains that these elected officials, no matter who they were not going to stand in front of and be able to stop, number one. Number two, there were halakhic issues. And I remember when I was working for the OU and Joe and I had this conversation about a particular issue, which was parental notification on abortion. If the young person involved needed the abortion was underage, and the halakhic position that we learned, and Joe was grateful for my notifying him of this, was that if the abortion was required by halakha, you don't even need parental notification. And right. He was astounded. He was kind of shy. Obviously, yeah, we'd rather be able to notify the parents. Nobody's suggesting that they shouldn't have notified the parents. But if the abortion was required by halacha, parental notification was not required, was pretty shocking to him that it would come from religious authorities. But, you know, issues like that and other issues are far more complicated when you're not talking about a halachic entity. It would be a lot more complicated in Israel to discuss, perhaps, than it is in the United States, where we're such a small fraction of the population. Yeah. So, you know, I think that, you know, there may be people who will grandstand on this issue and call him out and say he's not really a Frum Jew because of it. But no, I think he wrestled with these issues, and he wrestled about his potential impact. And again, always sought to play a role that would ultimately be seen as a Kiddush Hashem by most.
Since whoever would become the candidate would not be able to fight the public sentiment in this area, agreeing to this issue would allow Joe Lieberman and others to be able to do good in the areas where they could make a difference.
He was fond of quoting his friend Bill Clinton on the issue of abortion, which I don't think Democrats today can go around speaking this quote. And that was, Bill Clinton said when he was elected president, "I favor the woman's right to choose. However, I want to be the president where there are the least abortions ever." And Lieberman said, that's what we have to aspire to, not the other way around.
I can tell you, Willie, that when he was nominated, and I didn't have any relationship with him at all, but I'd heard about it, I knew who he was, there was such a sense of pride that I walked around with.
My wife and three sons all went to Los Angeles to be there for his nomination. My boys were 20, 19, and 9 at the time. And it was meaningful to have them be there and just look out there as this Frum Jew was nominated for the vice presidency of the United States. It meant a lot to us. I was telling a granddaughter of mine this morning about what Joe Lieberman meant for us. I mean, you know, she goes to yeshiva, but they haven't even spoken about Joe Lieberman this week, which is shocking. I gave her my book and she opened it up, you know, my Gift of Rest book. She opened it up and she was like stunned to see a handwritten note from Joe. And, you know, like,
do you mind reading what he inscribed?
Yeah, Sure. To my friend, Willie Rapfogel, with thanks for all you do on the 6 days of work and admiration for the way you rest on the seventh day, Joe Lieberman.
I think part of it was, and it wasn't just he's a Jew. Hey, I'm a Jew. It was that Jews can really be part of this world without necessarily being the Goldbergs or the Yenta or Fran Drescher and the Nanny, where they have to just be, you know, a certain stereotype, or, you know, like the type of Hasidim that show up in the Woody Allen movies. Here was a Jew. Okay. And the truth is, it's almost inconsequential.
Right.
It meant, you know, both you and I grew up in a period where our parents told us, wear a baseball cap when you go out in the street. Be careful in that neighborhood. Now, Lieberman didn't wear a yarmulke on the campaign trail, but still, this was an indicator that we had somehow pushed beyond. It was the normalcy, and that America could accept this, and that we didn't have to feel we were the other. We didn't have to feel that we were somehow something strange, and that could be attacked and pilloried and vilified just because the fact that we belonged to the tribe, that we were part of the group that rejected Christ. I think that's what gave me a sense of elation. However, I have to tell you that I was worried that if he would be elected, that there would somehow be some backlash against him.
Anything goes bad, they blame the Jews. Well, it was certainly on most Jewish people's minds. I don't think there's any question about that. On the other hand, there were also some positives. Jack Lew, when he was chief of staff to Barack Obama in the White House, told me that, and he said specifically that this was because of Joe Lieberman and how he proudly wore Shabbos as a vice presidential candidate, that Shabbos at Friday afternoons, whether it was the summertime or the wintertime, because I guess Barack Obama did not really distinguish Shabbos starting earlier or later, at 3 o'clock, he would tell Jack Lew, get out, go home. So 3 o'clock when Shabbos started at 7:30, or 3 o'clock when Shabbos started at 4:15, he had the same reaction. But Jack said it was because of Joe Lieberman keeping Shabbos as a vice presidential candidate that Obama was so sensitive to Jack Lew's need to leave for Shabbos.
If, had Lieberman, you know, become vice president, and again, you have the 9/11 attacks, the Islamic terrorism, he might have been put in very difficult situations, much more difficult than speaking out about affirmative action. He might have had to confront Israel, and he might have had to mouth and say over policies that ran counter to what the state of Israel was pursuing. That would have been a very difficult situation for Joe Lieberman, who we know loved the state of Israel and was an ardent Zionist. And you got to admit, Willie, that there hasn't been a pretty much of a greater lover of Israel as a president than W.
Well, he didn't start out that way. I mean, in fairness, a mere weeks, maybe a month before the 9/11 attacks, there was an article in New York Times about how W. welcomed his father into the Oval Office for the first time since he became president. And what did his father do from the Oval Office? He put W. on the phone with the King of Saudi Arabia to let him know that there's not going to be any difference between how the King of Saudi Arabia was going to be treated under W. than it was, obviously, under the father, which suggests that there was a change when Bill Clinton was president and so on. And a month later, the world completely changes. And the pro-Israel community was almost all with Al Gore in the 2000 elections, because Gore had an extensive record of being pro-Israel as a congressman, as a U.S. senator.
Sure, his father as well.
That's right. His father was a great senator who was beloved by pro-Israel community. We thought about George Herbert Walker Bush, and he was the guy pounding on the table against the, quote, Israeli lobbyists, which was really American Jews. So there was a lot of concern about him. But following the 9/11 attacks, and I think as he began to see what the danger of Islamic fundamentalism represented and the threat to Israel, he came around. And like you said, he became as good as any president as being pro-Israel. I suspect the same would have been true if Al Gore is president. I think it would have just strengthened his resolve to be more pro-Israel. And I think, if nothing else, Joe Lieberman would have been at his side, encouraging him to do that.
Lieberman was the trailblazer, and then you had, you know, so many others, as you and you know much better than I do, you know, that can lay tefillin and can have a minyan. Mm-hmm. And Lieberman talked about that in the interview that we're going to append to this conversation about when he was needing to say Kaddish and how they would always have a minyan together and do what they could. These are things which I think, you know, we need to be maskerim latov, to be maskerim latov of not being ashamed of his religiosity, of owning up to the mitzvahs that Klal Yisrael were given. And that way we have to say, you know, tizichrei borach, somebody who was willing to fight for Klal Yisrael, to fight for America, and to really show that you can be, you know, as he says in the interview that we're appending to this, to our talk, he was so taken by John F. Kennedy's call for service. It really, in a way that is important, I think, Willie, for our listeners to hear, that you can be a staunch patriot and lover of the United States and not have to sacrifice your connection to Klal Yisrael.
Very, very much so. And he was an incredible student of the American Jewish community as well, in incorporating that, because it mattered to him. He didn't want to see the American Jewish community in a bad light. Probably about a decade ago, I had a pretty extensive conversation with him. We were in Crown Heights, and there was some sort of memorial there that we went to, and a book had just come out about the Lubavitcher Rebbe called Social Vision. I don't know if you've ever seen that book. It really is an admiring book about how the Rebbe created this incredible Chabad infrastructure around the world, and social services and just childcare, just incredible. And Joe went on about how if only the rest of the Jewish community in America would tackle that kind of social vision instead of whatever it is that they're carving out for themselves, that we'd be a much better, much stronger American Jewish community. He spoke so admiringly of how the Lubavitcher Rebbe built this incredible network. At the same time, he was skeptical and cynical of some in the Chabad community who have kind of gone overboard. And, you know, we've seen that with some of the Mishachistas, and that's certainly a problem.
Yeah, well, he was a person that was very, I think, bereft of rancor. I think one of the reasons we know how moral he was, and that was, people say that's the reason, one of the reasons Gore chose him, was to sort of like distance himself from the, you know, the wild Clinton type of hijinks. But what I have garnered about him and what I've learned from listening to him is that he didn't seem to be a person that had a short fuse. He didn't seem to be a person that would be vindictive. He seemed to be a person that was trying to be Merutze Lakal and Mu'urav Bein Abriyos. And I think that's something that, just for that, we have to say, Willie, that we have to be Maspid and Odom Kosher, the schus of an Odom Kosher who's being brought to Kfuras Yisrael, Bataras Yisrael, and in a way that, you know, hopefully, you know, they talked about how he is going at this moment, you know, going b'shas hakvura into the yeshiva shalmaila, and hopefully able to be zocha to a reward of a Gan Eden. Family should have a nechama, his wife and children. Tizichrei baruch. Thanks, Willie.
Amen. Well. Amen. All right. We should hear b'saris tovus, and hopefully we'll have people who step up to fill the void that he leaves.
Tell us about where you grew up, what your early life experiences were like, in particular, maybe some of your early Jewish experiences, and what brought you into your early adulthood and, of course, eventually to your illustrious career.
Okay, I'll try to do that in less than 4 hours. So I was born in Stamford, Connecticut during the Second World War. So it gives you a sense of my generation. I was born into a family that was Orthodox, was certainly davened at the Orthodox shul. I was probably considered to be one of the more religiously observant families in Stamford at the time. That is at the time. And we spent the first 8 years of my life, my mother and father and I, my sister, and then a second sister was born, but I mentioned the first in the home of my grandmother, my mother's mother. Very important upbringing. She was, in some sense, my link to the old country. She was very pious. She was very warm, great sense of humor, just a very important force of my life. We used to joke, I joked anyway, that in my family, my mother and father were the trial court. So if you had a problem, you went before the court. However, if they ruled against you, you could appeal it to my grandmother, my baba.
He's the circuit court.
Yeah. And at the appellate court, the circuit court, the grandchildren never lost a case. It's a long time ago, but I can see that house on Hawthorne Street in Stamford, Connecticut. I can almost smell the aromas of my grandmother's cooking and my mother's cooking. And it was a very special place to grow up. And Jewish observance was part of it in a very warm, positive way.
Your grandmother was an immigrant?
My grandmother was an immigrant, but both of my parents were born here, but all four of my grandparents were immigrants. My grandmother and my grandfather, her husband, who I didn't know because he died in an accident very early. In fact, I'm named for him. His name was Joseph Yosef. They came from what was then Romania, part of the Austrian Empire, a little town called Stanovitz, which was near a big city called Chernivtsi. And my father's family, his father was Polish from around Krakow, and his mother was from Belarus, and they met in New York and got married. So four immigrant grandparents, both parents born in America. So when I was 8, my mom and dad bought our own house. We moved to it. My grandmother still came and spent at least half a week and then ultimately the whole week when she sold her house with us. But it was a great upbringing. I mean, in some sense, I say to people, you're a young rabbi, so there was a great TV show called Happy Days.
I remember.
With Richie Cunningham, yeah. Anyway, I feel like my upbringing was like that. It was a very multi-ethnic, somewhat multiracial, totally devoid of bias. I mean, we would tease each other about our ethnicity, but everybody really got on extremely well together. And that's the climate in which I grew up. I mean, let me pause because I could go on about my childhood.
And that would be wonderful. What would you say? Was there maybe one or two or several formative experiences early on for you?
It's an interesting question whether there are actual big events. Let's say this. The rabbi of our shul was a man named Joseph H. Ehrenkrantz, of blessed memory. He was very much a modern Orthodox rabbi, a student of Rav Soloveitchik, very involved in the community. And not only did he make religious observance interesting and understandable, but he spoke to us about our obligation to the broader community. So I can't think of a specific event. Oh, I can think after my early childhood. I was already at college. It was 1963. I happened to be working as a summer intern for my senator. So I'd already begun to develop interest in public service, obviously. Dr. Martin Luther King's March on Washington was in August of 1963. So I was right there in Washington. And of course, I went and marched. And who do I run into? My rabbi was there with a delegation from my hometown of Stamford, multi-religious, multiracial. I mean, it was just the kind of ethic that he set. It was also consistent with the values that I got from my parents. They were very firm, but they were very open-minded. They were very accepting of people who were different. And they did put a premium on my sisters and me to not only to do mitzvot and behave in a way that brought respect to the Jewish people and to our family, but also to be involved in the life of the community. Though neither of my parents were in politics, they were very active in the Jewish community. My dad particularly followed public events very closely. I mean, he was from that generation that if he didn't read the New York Times on a given day, it would be as if he failed to daven shacharis, let's say. So that was the house. Now, if you ask me about specific events, I would say, interestingly, in terms of my life and my career, that the election of President Kennedy in 1960 was a seminal event in my life.
Why?
Why? Because he was a very appealing candidate. I mean, he was a young man. He was in his early 40s. He brought together what to me seemed like a right combination of strong foreign policy, a progressive domestic policy. There was also a way, which I never really articulated to anybody, but thinking back at it now, I know it was in my mind. I identified with him because he was a Roman Catholic. He was of a minority religion in America, although there were a lot more.
More than Jews, right?
And in Connecticut, it happened to be that the Catholics were the, if not the majority, at least the plurality of the populations. And, you know, he faced some really terrible bigotry, although he overcame it during the campaign. When he won, it did, I think, say to me and probably a lot of other people that, I might say, a door opened up for all of us. I wasn't thinking of running for president, believe me. But I was beginning to think of a political career. And so Kennedy's election was a catalytic event, a formative event. I mean, I'll jump forward and tell you another formative event. When I went to college, I went to Yale. I started to be less religiously observant. When I look back at it, it almost seems like what I was doing was so predictable and trite. You know, to me, it seemed like I was, well, this was my decision. I was making choices. But really, it's what a lot of college students do. And I look back at it and I kind of laugh at myself. So I stopped being Shomer Shabbos. And there are certain things that I couldn't stop. It's fascinating to me. Throughout that entire period, I continued to put on tefillin every morning. Sometime I davened awfully quickly. But there was something about that connection with the tefillin that kept me there. Now, why do I mention this? Well, it's part of the progression. And I think it's important. I stayed in New Haven and went to Yale Law School. I was married. In 1967, my first child was going to be born. And a few months before that, my grandmother, who I've mentioned, passed away. So there were now two dramatic life cycle events that were occurring in my life. One, I was about to become a father, so a new generation was beginning. Second, my link to my own personal history, my grandmother, my closest link, had ended. And for me, I began to think very seriously about religious observance. And to put it in the most simplistic sense, and sometimes you make big decisions that are really quite simple, although they're profound, which is, am I going to continue to be so-so observant, but not so observant? I've lost my grandmother. I have a child coming, turned out to be a son. So I began to see that metaphor that I bet my rabbi gave me about Judaism as a chain of links. And but it's a little bit different, really. Am I going to let the history stop with my grandmother and our family, or am I going to carry it on? And I began to come back to religious observance, to being a Shomer Shabbos, et cetera, et cetera. So those were, I mean, that comes to mind, those are somewhat unusual formative events, but both in terms of my public life and my private life, they were very formative.
Well, it seems like there's really quite a fusion between the two, in that the values with which you were suffused as a young person and which your rabbi really both preached and practiced. Is it fair to say that those private values ultimately precipitated your public engagement and your desire to get involved in politics? And
The answer is yes. I mean, there's no question. A lot of times people in all the years since then will say to me, why did you get into politics? And I'd say, well, of course, I've thought about that myself. And the answers are that my parents set an example for community service. Also, in Kennedy's election was won, I began to read quite actively in high school and college biographies and histories, just to basically reaching the conclusion that leaders can have a positive or negative effect on history. But then I said the final is that the Torah education I received, the Torah values, some of the basic ideas that, you know, we're not here by accident. Hashem created the heaven and the earth and the people here. In that sense, as our Declaration of Independence says, we're all equal. And a whole set of policies come from that. But also that we have an obligation, whatever you call it, to do Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name, to do Tikkun Olam, to try to better or even perfect the world, but Malchut Shaddai, under the sovereignty of God. Those are motivating values. And also, I would say, and I think sometimes this is overlooked, that Judaism is a religion of law. You know, we talk a lot about the rule of law in different countries. It makes a country civilized or not. But the whole Jewish narrative of history, you know, begins with the Brit between God and Abraham, the covenant. That in itself is a kind of legal agreement. But really, the climatic moment is we have God's fulfillment that he remembered the covenant when the Jewish people were enslaved in Egypt and liberated them from slavery, but not just to sort of live in Egypt or to wander in the desert, although they did for 40 years. It was to go to get their essentially national mission statement, which was the Ten Commandments in the Torah on Mount Sinai. So there's a basic presumption in Judaism that, put it in its sharpest way, freedom is not enough. By our birth, we have a right to be free, but we need law. We need law to protect us from each other, essentially, and to bring out in each of us our better nature. Now, why do I say this? Because I think that set of values that I learned from my religious education had an effect on the way I saw my life in public office as a lawmaker, or as a law enforcer during the time I was Attorney General of Connecticut. So, you know, I've been really lucky. I've been very fortunate. I've even used the term blessed, although Jews don't use it enough. I've been blessed to have the opportunities that I've had to be of service in that way.
Now, so you were a young man, obviously precocious and ambitious. Equally, you were at Yale University, Law School. I guess you liked New Haven. And you ended up becoming a young attorney. And then just very briefly, how did you move from that early station to the real meteoric success that you had throughout the next part of your career?
Well, yeah, thanks. So, you know, I look back on it. And one thing I'd say is that there were various times in which I took risks. You know, you have to take risks. And I could have failed and my life would have taken different turns. But thank God, for the most part, everything worked out, although I did lose elections at various times. It's just the nature of the way it is. I always say to people who've come to me over the years, particularly after I'd been in politics for a while and asked for advice about political careers. And I would always say, from my experience, I would say, you have to work hard. You have to go out and get yourself known and meet people. And then at some point, you have to decide, probably, unless you're very unusual, very lucky, you have to take a risk. You have to decide, I think I can do a better job at that office than the person there now. And I think I'm able to explain that to people. And then I always say to people, you're never going to be certain you're going to win. But I will just say my own value set, don't do it if you don't think you have any chance to win. In other words, you have to have a feeling that it's possible you could win. So I stayed in New Haven, much to my surprise. I always thought I'd go back to Stanford, but I got a law firm. It was a little better in New Haven than Stanford. And I think I had become close to Yale, and it was a little hard to leave it at that point. But anyway, stayed in New Haven, got active in the community, in the Jewish community, in the political community, et cetera. I was only 27 years old when I declared for a state senator. The incumbent state senator was running for the U.S. Senate. Most everybody thought he was not going to win that, and he would come back and run for the state Senate. He was known as a tough guy. Later, he and I became friends. His name was Ed Marcus. Nobody else wanted to say that they would be ready to run against him if he lost and came back. But I was a 27-year-old. I was too foolish. And I had nothing to lose. You know, I was on. So I stayed in. He did lose the U.S. Senate primary, came back, and we ran against each other. And I won by very little, but I won. So that started my career. I was 10 years in the state Senate, the last six as majority leader. I was very close to a woman named Ella Grasso, who became the first woman governor in her own right of an American state. I mean, in her own right, meaning that she didn't succeed her husband or something like that. Unfortunately, she died of cancer in 1980. And I always thought that she'd be a candidate for national office if she had lived longer. But I was there for 10 years, the last six as Senate Majority Leader during the 6 years Ella Grasso was governor. And then my congressman, Bob Gimo, surprised everybody in 1980, said he wasn't going to run for office again. He was retiring. I never yearned to be a congressman. I was dreaming of being governor and then senator. But, you know, I had this feeling an opportunity comes along. Who knows when another opportunity will come along? These are lessons you can learn in politics that are not always good for you. So I ran and I lost. It was quite an experience. Why did I lose? First off, I did run into the Reagan landslide, but I also didn't run a good campaign. And I learned a lot about that in that campaign. The other thing I learned is about what can be the therapeutic value of a good defeat every now and then. So I was walking around after the election and people would come up and express their remorse, their sadness. And after a while, I said, you know, they're treating me as if I died. I'm alive. I'm alive. By that time I was 37, and I just lost an election. So I'm going to go on. And I did. And it happened that 2 years later, there was an opportunity to run for attorney general. Again, I took a chance. I declared when the incumbent was still in there. It wasn't clear he was going to run. He ultimately didn't run. And there was a nomination fight at a convention, and I won. And I won the election. I had 6 wonderful years as attorney general. I loved it, really. It was a great job.
I interviewed Nat Lewin, and he said that you perhaps stood together on some legislation to promote Jewish values.
Yeah, that was great. Nat is just a wonderful person, a great lawyer, and he's just done extraordinary things through the law. So I guess I knew Nat not very well, called me out of the blue. He called me on behalf of COLPA. I always forget what it stands for, but it was an Orthodox Jewish Legal Rights organization, and said that, you know, they reviewed cases and they interestingly had found a case that was coming to the Supreme Court, brought by the estate of a man who had worked for a department store chain here in Connecticut. That man was Donald Thornton. It's a long time ago, but I remember it. And see, we had had blue laws in Connecticut, not concerning Shabbos, but Sunday. He couldn't run a business on a Sunday. We repealed those laws. They were thought to be antiquated. In the law, we said that a business has to accommodate the religious beliefs of its employees. And basically, Mr. Thornton and I and Nat felt that Thornton's employer, which was a chain called Caldor, which strangely enough was founded and owned by a family that were members of my shul in Stanford, the Circle of Life. So Nat said that the case was actually coming to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he was arguing on behalf of the estate of Donald Thornton, and he'd give me half the time of his time, a half hour before the court, 15 minutes for me, to argue on behalf of the state, which had an interest in protecting the statute. And we had a great time preparing. I thought we were absolutely right. Unfortunately, the court ruled 8-1 against us.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's timing, and I think that the court had just issued a couple of decisions that made people wonder whether they were really blurring the church-state line. And I think they took this as a case in which they were going to reassure people, no, we were not going to let the law protect religious observance too much. So, but it was a great experience, and it did ultimately lead to other cases that upheld that to the point that Nat and I hope to argue.
So you were attorney general, and then when did a Senate seat possibility?
So, I mean, I have so many stories around this, I'll try to be selective. So in my mind, I dreamed of being governor, and then if everything worked out, I'd be a senator. Part of that was, I think, because of the path followed by Senator Abraham Ribicoff, who had been a governor and a senator from Connecticut, a Jewish man. I had worked for him that summer. I was in Washington during Martin Luther King's March on Washington, and he became a mentor to me. He was really a remarkable person. So I was elected attorney general in 1982, reelected in 1986. In 1988, there was a Senate seat up, and the Democratic Party didn't have a candidate, really, because the incumbent Republican senator, his name was Lowell Weicker, was quite popular, it appeared, and also had a fair amount of Democratic support. So the party people began to come to me and say, look, 1988, you'll be in the middle of your attorney general term. You have nothing to lose. And why don't you run?
Were you the sacrificial lamb or?
Well, that's what I said. I don't want to be the sacrificial lamb. Then my pollster did some polling, a fellow named Stan Greenberg, and said, you know, Weicker is not as strong as people think he is. He said, I got to be honest. In the latest poll we've done, you're 25 points behind him. When I think back to that, I wonder, how did they convince me to run? But Dan Greenberg's counsel was, unless you really follow up, if you get to run against him for U.S. Senator, even if you lose, you will raise your visibility so much that you will be a much stronger candidate for governor in 1990 when the governor is not expected to run again. Anyway, it was not an easy decision. I'll tell you a cute little story. It was Labor Day of 1987, and Greenberg came over to our house, talked to my wife and me and a few campaign leaders for me. And he had a particular scenario about how we would run against the incumbent Republican senator. And at one point, just out of the blue, he said to Hadassah, my wife, if you really want to help this campaign, Hadassah, you'll become pregnant and have a child. So I said, Stan.
Not very PC.
Now, the strangest thing was we knew that Hadassah was pregnant. But it was very early in the pregnancy. We're not telling anybody. So we laughed and, oh, yeah, right away. And then about a month and a half later, I called Greenberg and I said, Stan, there are some people who listen to their pollsters and some people who ignore them. I'm telling you how much I listen to you. Hadassah is pregnant. No! So our little Hani, now 29, was born in March of the campaign year. It was quite a thing. Anyway, I finally decided to run. It was very, very tough campaign. I was way behind for most of it. At the end, I pulled kind of close. And then I won by less than 1% of the vote out of about 1,300,000 votes cast. I just tell you this cute story. Everybody always says, you know, victory has 1,000 parents and defeat is an orphan. The night opened in my hotel suite in Hartford with a few people in the suite, not too many. It was pretty obvious to everybody I was going to lose. As the returns started to come in and a few of the networks declared I was the winner about 9 p.m., we were not prepared to do that. We thought it was going to be very close. The suite began to fill up. When we finally decided after 11 p.m. that I could go down and declare victory, I really felt I had to talk to Hadassah for a minute. There was nowhere to go. So I pulled her into the restroom, the hotel suite, closed the door, and she looked at me and said, sweetheart, I thought you were just doing this to raise your visibility so you could run for governor in 2 years. And so I said, you know, Baruch Hashem, who knows what hand is guiding us? We're on our way to Washington. And
be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah, right. And Hadassah's been just a really extraordinary wife in every way, and really Eshet Chayil, including her support of my political activities, which are not easy. So we arrived in Washington as a new U.S. senator in January of 1989.
There's so much I want to ask you about, and with respect to a long political career from then. I guess, in our brief time, just what were some of the signature achievements that you feel most proud of during that time? And then, importantly, how did your very visible Jewish faith factor in? Of course, later on, it would become really supercharged, and we'll get to that. But just in this period in the Senate, what were some of those experiences, challenges, triumphs, both politically and religiously?
So if you ask me first the things I'm proudest of, I would say, first in context, that everything that I'm really most proud of, I did with members of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. In other words, they were all bipartisan. I worked very actively in the amendments to the Clean Air Act under President Bush 41 with the Democratic majority in the Senate. And I think we really improved those acts in a way that have enabled more people to live longer lives because they weren't getting sick from air pollution. I was also quite active in a bipartisan group, Senators McCain, Dole, Biden, and me particularly, four of us, pushing the president, first Bush and then Clinton, to get more involved in the Balkans after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union, to stop the genocide that was being carried out against Muslims, particularly in Bosnia. And ultimately, we were successful. I'm just jumping ahead. It happened that I was chairman of or ranking member of the committee of the Senate, later became the Homeland Security Committee, then called Governmental Affairs, on 9/11. And our committee brought forth the legislation that created the Department of Homeland Security. We created a commission to investigate 9/11, bipartisan commission of citizens. It made a very important report. And then we led the way in adopting the report, which was the largest reform of our intelligence and particularly intelligence and defense agencies and foreign policy since the beginning of the Cold War, which was appropriate because we were starting a new phase in our history, which was the war with radical Islamic terrorism. So those are some of the things that I feel best about. I always worked on human rights, going back to what I said originally about, you know, everybody comes from the same God. And so I've been active in civil rights and women's rights. And again, always working with Republicans. And when I look back, you know, some of my best friends still now are people people like John McCain and Susan Collins, who are both Republicans, but obviously that didn't matter. We just worked together. We became friends. And now you asked me the second question about my Judaism. You know, if you work at it, obviously kashrut can be dealt with, most of your davening. When I was saying Kaddish, incidentally, for my mother in 2005, we had a great system for having a minion in my office for mincha. My secretary, you know, knocked out the message every day. Who's coming? Can you come? And then what we got to. But the challenges really were around voting on the Yom Tovim or on a Makor Shabbat.
Interesting.
Yeah, and really more the Yom Tovim than otherwise. There were probably over my 24 years in the Senate, I never really sat down to count. I would guess 40, 50 times when the Senate voted on Shabbat. And, you know, I talked to my rabbis and they all said, if you know you're going to have to be there Friday night and Saturday, stay at on the Capitol Hill. If you think you're only going to be there Friday evening, you have the opportunity to come home, walk home. Or if you know it's going to be Saturday morning, walk in on Saturday. If for some reason you don't have that advance notice and you have to take a ride from somebody who's not Jewish. And the last of all, which I never had to do, was if it's really an emergency, get in a car and drive yourself. So most of the time, I could see the votes coming, and I would either walk home late at night from the Capitol or walk in Shabbat morning. And ultimately, even though I lived a pretty good ways away, and my legs were in better shape than they are now, although I have two metal knees, so I'm sure I could do it again.
But just don't go through the metal detectors.
No, right. So it all worked out, and as I think has been the case with my observance generally in my political life, it has not put people off. It has actually brought people closer to me or given people a kind of respect that I was consistent about it. Really, going back to when I was a state senator, so there were hardly ever votes in the state senate on Shabbat, but there were testimonial dinners for people who would help me in my last campaign. There were picnics for the local Democratic organizations who helped me in my last campaign. And so at first, people were either puzzled or sometimes angry that I couldn't come. But when I explained to them that it was my Sabbath and I couldn't be involved in politics, I would do everything I could to carry out my public responsibilities. They accepted it and respected it. And really, I'd like to say to young people today, Jewish or not Jewish, that I believe we're living at a time in the history of this country where you will not have to choose between your religious observance and your personal career goals. And that's a great thing to be able to say. And I know it wasn't always so. It wasn't so in my parents' generation and certainly not in my grandparents'.
As a senator, I know that over the years, your own role evolved and eventually, if I'm correct, you became an independent. In many ways, you may have sort of stood alone at times, apart from your own party. Did you ever analogize that to your Jewish identity, where I think of Abraham as a man standing apart? Politically, do you ever feel like I need to stand up for certain values, even if that means I'm a man standing apart? And did you take inspiration from Judaism in that regard?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I will say that in all my years, and I'm not a child anymore, nobody's asked me that question or framed it that way. So I would say two things. One is, I don't think I ever in my mind made the exact connection that you've suggested, that, you know, Avraham Avinu stood up, went against the mood of the time for something he believed was right. But I think that was inside me. In other words, I think those were the heroic role models, people who, in a way, put values, nation ahead of self-interest or narrow interests. And I think it's part of why Jews disproportionately end up being involved in, for instance, social justice movements. Still true. Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has been talking publicly about this lately. It's fascinating to hear her. She didn't come from a particularly religious family. She's not particularly religious herself, but she feels that Jewishness in her expressed itself in a sensitivity to the rights of individuals, particularly those who are being deprived of their rights, and a willingness to take on the fight, which she did, particularly before she went to the Supreme Court, on behalf of women. You know, it always is a fascinating question about the effect, maybe somebody's already done this book, but how you link the Jewish ethics, and just the way you've said, stand up, do what's right, you know, work for justice, have mercy, that express themselves so often in Jewish leaders who are not religious. So you can't directly say, he or she got that from their rabbi. I was lucky enough to get it from my rabbi. A lot of others didn't, but somehow, I don't know whether it's in the DNA or what, but it's something to be proud of, and it is part of our Torah legacy, really.
As a rabbi, I would suggest that it's in the spiritual DNA of the Jewish soul.
Yeah. No, that's a good way to put it.
Take me quickly to the vice presidential running, and what was that like? Obviously, that took things to a whole nother level of visibility. What was that about? And then, as well, you've written a book about Shabbat, about observing Shabbat, and the gift of Shabbat, I believe it's called. How did that tie in? Was that precipitated by your vice presidential run? And where did that fit into the whole picture?
So the opportunity to run for vice president was way beyond anything I ever dreamed about. I'm a dreamer. You know, I know my name is Yossi, although I'm not sure I always interpret dreams as well as he did. But this was way beyond my dreams. I will be forever grateful to Al Gore, who asked me to do this. It's a very personal choice by the probable presidential nominee. He took a risk, but he did it with confidence that the American people would judge me and our ticket based on our qualifications, not on our religion. And we did, after all, get 544,000 more votes than the other. I don't want to say that to relitigate the election. So I would say that overall, it was, except for that recount, it was an extraordinary experience. And the American people were just wonderful in greeting my wife, Adassa, and me. And there was great interest in my religious observance. And again, it was not a barrier. I think it was a positive, if anything. Of course, Adassa and I felt strongly that we had a real obligation, not only to do the best we could for Al Gore and the ticket, but to represent the Jewish people and our own religion as best we could. And overall, I feel pretty good about how we did. Well, the book was something that was in me for a long time. I will tell you that my fourth term was ending in the Senate in 2012. I had pretty much decided that I wasn't going to run again. I wasn't going to announce it till the beginning of 2011. But I hadn't definitely decided. But I had enough money in my campaign account. I didn't have to be running around the country raising money. So I stopped. And I thought, I've got a time opening in my schedule. And this is what I want to do. I love Shabbat. I feel Shabbat is a gift from God. And people would say to me sometimes, how can you be a U.S. senator and take one day off every week? And of course, my answer is not original, but how could I be a U.S. senator and not take a day off every week? It helps me to do everything else, to work harder during the other 6 days, and to have perspective, clearer perspective on what I'm doing the other 6 days. So I wrote the book, and I'll tell you, I love the responses I get to the book. It's mostly been read by Jewish people, but it's been read by a lot of non-Jews who also said that they appreciated it and appreciated the idea of a day of rest. I think in the end that writing that book on Shabbat will be one of the most significant things I've accomplished in my life. And I have been privileged to accomplish a lot of things legislatively, politically, et cetera. So that's how it happened. And, you know, strangely enough, not that any of my books is a bestseller, but I've written 7 books. And the one that sold the most was the Shabbat book.
There you go. This is the 7th book, by the way.
The 7th book, right.
In closing, tell our listeners what you're doing now and what your aspirations are for the future, and especially what do you think some of the great challenges are facing the Jewish people now, and where are we going?
That's hard to do. Briefly, when I announced that I wasn't running again for re-election, somebody sent me a quote from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which I paraphrase, which is that the modern idea of retirement is based on a misconception that there are productive and unproductive periods of life. Every day you're alive, you can be productive. And I would add, in fact, although as you age, there are some things you can't do as well as you did when you were younger. There are other things that you're better at just because you have experience. So I joined a law firm in New York, Kasowitz Benson, half-time. I'm teaching a course every year and lecturing at Yeshiva University. I'm involved in a host of causes, an organization called No Labels, which works to try to bring our government back to more bipartisanship, nonpartisanship. A couple of organizations, one called United Against Nuclear Iran, which obvious purpose stated in its name, another one, the Counter Extremism Project, and on a couple of corporate boards. But it's been actually a wonderful period of life. We moved to Riverdale, New York, where 2 of our 4 children live with 5 of our grandchildren, so we get to see them quite a lot. So the challenges for the Jewish people, I mean, I'm an optimist. I always say that we're living in probably the greatest period in Jewish history today. The Beit Mikdash is not in Jerusalem, but in every other way, the reestablishment of the state, the dynamism of the state, the davening that goes on at the Kotel every day, the religious activity within Israel and the strength of the American Jewish community. I mean, this country has been more open, more accepting of Jews than any other country outside of Israel in our entire history. But there are challenges that come with that. We know all about assimilation and all the rest of it. You know, I'm an optimist. I think that the Jewish people are an eternal people, but it doesn't get as good as it should be unless we're working to observe the mitzvot and trying, beginning with our own families, to pass on the torch, to do what I did at that moment I had when my grandmother died and my son was about to be born. Because ultimately, it's up to us.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.